Okay, meeting will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum, so we'll proceed. I don't think we, do we? 8, 9, 10, we do, because Emma was here. I'm sorry, we do have a quorum. Representative Cornish.
I've got older proxies.
That works some places, not in the legislature.
You're good.
That's the new Cornish role. And he's got a gun to back it up. So if anybody wants to argue it. Representative Cornish moves the minutes of the last meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Wins 2-0. Okay, the first thing today will Judge Gomez will just give a very quick overview, and then we will first of all get into the actual how the guidelines and the grid work and what they really mean. A lot of people have asked me what in the world do those mean, including people that have been on it 10 years on the committee. So that will be first, and then Judge Schumacher from the appellate court will explain the role of the judge at trial court and with regard to sentencing and also some appellate issues. And then we'll go back, if we still have time, to other guidelines issues. So, Judge Gomez.
Thank you, Chairman Mueller. We really appreciate the opportunity to address the committee once more. I guess I didn't address this committee previously, but a lot of you heard probably too much from me on Tuesday, and I assure you that I'm not going to repeat all the things that I said on Tuesday. I want to introduce who's here today. We have to my immediate left, as you've heard, Judge Gordon Schumacher of the Minnesota Court of Appeals, formerly a Ramsey County trial judge and one of the judge members, one of the three judge members of the commission. So he's a guidelines commissioner as well. Then Linda McBrayer. Linda McBrayer is our trainer at the Guidelines Commission, among many other things. She personally trained those 500 practitioners I referenced the other day.
Judge Gomez, I just have a question. Does she have to train judges?
Yes.
Oh, my condolences.
Come on. And to her left, we have Lee Meadows, who is our IT man and one of our senior researchers. And I'm Isabel Gomez. I'm the director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. You've got half of the staff here. So left in the office are 2.75 FTEs. I guess I want simply to do enough recap to set just a little bit of a context for the technical discussion. Basically, there are two kinds of sentences. Indeterminate sentences, in which it is not known how long the offender will actually do in prison until a parole board or corrections board at some point determines that he can get out. So when he goes in, there's no knowing how long he's going to be there. The other kind of sentence is the kind of sentence we have in Minnesota, which are determinate sentences, where on the day of sentencing, the judge pronounces a sentence, and it is known by everybody in the courtroom exactly how much time that individual has to do. Now, in the 1970s, there was widespread discontent with the failures that seemed to be glaringly apparent, failures of the indeterminate sentencing schemes that were all there was at that time. Minnesota, in the way we do, designed a solution. And the solution is the Minnesota State Sentencing Guidelines, which were the first in the nation. Probably the first in the world, have been copied by many jurisdictions, and are frankly widely admired. I had not truly understood that until I took this job and started talking with people from other jurisdictions inside the United States and outside the United States concerning guidelines issues. Now, you're going to hear just a quick run-through of how the guidelines work, and we want you to interrupt copiously. Frankly, it's the only way you'll be able to stand it, and you know how it is. If you're looking at rules and laws in the abstract, become rather unintelligible if they're not related to specific real-life issues. That'll be short, but still. Before we get there, I simply want to say what we get out of this guideline system, which is the reason why other people are interested in having it. First of all, we get proportionality. More serious offenses carry heavier price tags, which are actually served. Less serious offenses carry lesser price tags, which are actually served or worked through. We get to avoid disparities. We do not end up with two people with similar criminal histories who commit the very same offense, one of whom gets out in 18 months and one of whom gets out in 6 years, and then wants to know why, and nobody is required to explain. We are able, and this is so important, we take it for granted in Minnesota, it can't be done at all in most jurisdictions. We are able to plan and to predict the strain on state resources that arises out of various criminal laws. That means that Minnesota has never risked or come near a situation in which some federal court was going to tell us that our prisons were dangerously overcrowded and we had to let people go, and then we couldn't figure out who to let go. That has never happened here. It never will, as long as we have guidelines. And we are able to track who we've got and to track how any category of case is being handled by judges and prosecutors. We really must not take this for granted. You'll be seeing, if you haven't already, the DLC prison bed projections. It's astonishing how close they are to the reality, particularly compared with the efforts of anyone else who's trying to do this kind of tracking. And very important, we in Minnesota have promised certain things to victims. We have provided certain rights to victims, and they are all, or a lot of them, hinged on the fact that Minnesota sentences are certain and transparent. The day of the sentencing, as I said, a victim can know when the person who offended against her will be getting out of prison. Exactly. She knows that she has done everything she can to impact the sentence and can go on with her life. She does not have to plan testimony for future probation hearings, keep an eye on what's happening with that offender, and try to make sure to show up again and again to argue against that offender's release. We could not do for victims what we have committed to do for victims with an indeterminate system. These guidelines, as I say, are going to seem confusing to you. I simply want to say that they amount to 54 pages, which may seem a lot. The late unlamented federal guidelines amounted to 600 plus. So it's really not that complicated. And now I will turn it over to Linda McClair.
Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Tamar?
Just a question first?
Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Gomez, I didn't have an opportunity to ask this at the last hearing when you presented to the other committee. And, you, and here as
Mr.
well
Tamar,
as...
you should talk to the chair of that last committee.
I was trying to be fair and let everybody else.
Your other personality in that schizophrenic.
There were two points, and I heard you make the point today, that it allows us to predict how many inmates will be in our institutions. But why is it that I think it was 2 years ago now, last biennium, the Department of Corrections had predicted a huge spike in inmates in our prisons, and you know, the sky was falling, the whole thing, and that all, I assume, came out of the sentencing guidelines. So I'm just wondering how that fits when you say you can accurately predict.
That is a good question, Chairman Mulready, Chairman Paymar. First of all, at that point, I believe the Sentencing Guidelines Commission was not participating in those projections. I'm hesitating to speak for DOC, but I'm pretty sure what that came from was looking back to a huge spike that had already occurred in meth commitments, and then backing that down so that the spike would not continue to be so stunning. It really was stunning. And backing it down to what seemed like a reasonable level. And also probably not reckoning with the enormous departure rates that would be occurring in meth cases, including meth manufacture. Even first-degree meth manufacture, only 40% of the people who have a presumptive sentence commit sentence get it. So, again, in all respect, we have to get DOC to look at that.
Okay.
And also, I guess I would say that in comparison with the kinds of projections that go on elsewhere, that was not bad.
And Mr. Chair, one final question, if I could. When you were talking about why you support indeterminate sentences to the degree that you do, I don't disagree with you that it takes out bias and there's consistency in how long people stay in our institutions. But some criminologists are saying that when you have indeterminate sentences, that there's really no motivation for inmates in our institutions to get job training, to go to treatment, to do the things that we would like them to do before they get released. And could you just comment on that? Because I think that's, and I asked you the other day if there's a way to blend determinate and indeterminate sentences, and you said no.
Right.
But there is this unintended consequence of indeterminate sentencing, in my opinion, and I just like your comment.
Judge Gomez, before you answer that, I think you should clear up. I think you're talking about determinate sentences, not indeterminate.
I think you may have misspoken, Chairman.
All right, determinate.
So that we get it right on record, and that your question answer is to his real question. Okay, thank you, Judge Gomez.
Mulready, for the clarification. First of all, I think there are a lot of ways to provide incentives for people to do programming in prison. Secondly, the current research says that where you want programming, in particular, is at the point close to reentry, so that part of the programming gets done in prison and the balance of the programming gets done outside of prison in a supervised release situation. There's a lot of research that shows that it's far more effective than treatment programs in either side. So you kind of want that bridge. If you talk to our Department of Corrections concerning how they would rate prison management, population management problems against projection, I don't think that they're particularly worried about management. And the bottom line is that research shows, and you know, there are a lot of things that remain to be researched in the 21st century, and that's really exciting, because I hope this legislature ultimately will decide what some of those things are. The research clearly shows no correlation between inmates' participation in prison programs and their behavior, positive behavior in prison, and whether they will recidivate. None. Zero. The only correlation there is between prison behavior and behavior in the world is related to bad behavior in prison. If people can't behave in prison, then you know pretty much 100% they aren't going to behave outside of prison either. So, you know, I just think we're in a situation in the 21st century where we can use facts to drive policy. And we're all entitled to opinions. I think everybody needs to pay more attention to opinions that are based on facts.
Thank you.
Judge Schumacher, have you had time to
collect my thoughts?
Yes, that's a nice way to say it.
Okay.
Okay, that was originally how we had planned it. And since we've been almost a half hour getting to what we were going to do in that time, so is there another question before we... Yeah, okay. Then what Judge Schumacher is here for is to explain the role of the trial judge in the sentencing manner, the whole issue of what you do with probation, bail, the different issues that you face, the different kinds of sentences you can give. And then since you're now in the appellate court, you can discuss the issues that come up there. And I hate to say anything good about a judge, but actually Judge Schumacher I've known since, I won't even say back when, long time ago, and he is highly respected among attorneys. A lot of judges want to give CLEs, and usually that discourages attorneys from going, but I remember when he'd give CLEs, the room would be packed, and that's really unusual, so it's hard to say something good about you, but I must admit the truth. One second. Melanie, do you want to come down, or you're certainly invited to the table. You want to stay back there? Okay. Judge Schumacher, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Chairman Mullery, and I appreciate the glowing compliments. I gotta think about those. Chairman Mullery asked me to address some issues of sentencing from the standpoint of a sentencing judge, and I was a trial judge in Ramsey County for 16 years and had many, 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 many sentencings. So what I'm going to say is, at least my practices, but I think they were pretty standard and uniform. However, I don't speak for other judges on this. So I thought maybe the way to do this was to kind of take you through step by step, at least in a general way, what happens in a sentencing. And if you don't mind, we do have some slides. We won't, at this point, just do the statistical stuff, but I want you to see the sentencing guidelines grid and the worksheet and so forth. And Linda can display those as we go along. And perhaps the best thing for me to do is to take a hypothetical felony, because the guidelines, as you know, pertain only to felonies. The gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor level crimes are not part of the guidelines. By felony, I mean any crime in Minnesota for which more than 1 year in prison may be imposed. So, you know, before I went to law school and learned a little bit about this stuff, I'd hear about a sentence 12 months and 1 day, and I thought, what kind of mean-spirited people would rub it in and give one more day, and I never understood what that was all about. Well, that converts the sentence into a felony, because now we've got we're beyond 12 months, and that's what it's all about. So let's assume we have someone who is charged with a crime, and he either goes to trial and is found guilty, or he pleads to either that crime or some plea bargained crime, some version of it, or an amended charge. By the way, most of the cases that are sentenced come from pleas. We have a lot of trials and convictions, but most come from pleas. When you plead guilty and are judged guilty, then that's a conviction. So let's assume we have either one of those situations. It is a felony, so we start with the proposition that I must follow the guidelines. Even though they're called guidelines, they are mandates, but mandates with a little bit of a safety valve. So in other words, I presume that when this person is going to be sentenced for a felony, felony crime in Minnesota, I presume that I will give him the sentence called for by the guidelines. Now, I think you probably all know the safety valve is that if there are substantial and compelling circumstances that suggest maybe this person ought to get a different sentence, then if I articulate, and I mean articulate, I need to put that in writing or on the record, and ultimately that can be captured in writing, I need to tell what those substantial and compelling circumstances are that would make the sentence that I'm going to give more appropriate than the guideline sentence. Then if I do that, then it's called a departure from the guidelines. So I want to give you that kind of general background. And also, please, if you have questions as I go along, I don't mind being interrupted. And, you know, if I misstate something, you know, otherwise, let me know, because I don't want to do that.
Yes, members, be sure to do that, because this is the only time you're going to get to interrupt a judge. They love to interrupt you. But
go ahead. Representative Mallory has never been shy about interrupting, so you know, so I'm used to that with him. But okay, here are some sentence possibilities before we actually get to the guidelines. We use some jargon, some legal terms. It can be an executed sentence. In an executed sentence, and remember, I'm always talking about felonies now, an executed sentence is a prison sentence. In other words, we give a certain amount of time that is expressed in months, and if it's executed, the person is committed to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections for service of that time. Or it can be a stay of execution. With a stay of execution, we give the months. Let me put this in more concrete terms. I sentence this individual to 48 months to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections. So I'm executing the sentence. When I use that magic language, this person gets shipped to the custody of the commissioner. Or I sentence this person to 48 months to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections, but I stay the execution of that sentence, place him on probation for 10 years on the following conditions, and I'll get to that. So we have either an executed sentence or stay of execution, and we have one more that we use at the felony level, and that's a stay of imposition of sentence. In that one, we say, I find you guilty of such and such a crime. I stay the imposition of sentence for 10 years, and I place you on probation under these conditions. The difference between the stay of execution and the stay of imposition is this. If execution is stayed, I've already pronounced the felony sentence. He ends up with a felony record, period, unless it's reversed on appeal, but he ends up with a felony record. If I stay imposition of a sentence, and he completes all of his probationary conditions satisfactorily, at the end of the probationary period, when he's discharged from probation, it reverts to a misdemeanor sentence. So you're not going to have any high-level people crimes, likely. You know, I better not speak that broadly, but it's generally not the practice for high-level people crimes to have stays of imposition. So those three possibilities. The other one you were mentioning, Chairman Mallory, is a stay of adjudication, and that's caused all kinds of problems, where it's kind of like not even adjudging him guilty, and that's only done in very, very narrow circumstances properly, where the prosecutor has in effect committed prosecutorial misconduct by the charge, and I don't see that happening much. So the three that I've just told you are the ones that are the ones that we're looking at.
Judge Schumacher, Representative Johnson, I believe you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Schumacher, I just want to, I don't know if there's an answer to this or not, but do judges ever do stays, or how often do they do stays, because they're concerned about prisons being too full, and therefore they're thinking, well, I can't answer.
Well, I don't know. We're asking judges broadly, but I'll speak for myself in what I know of other judges when this has come up. That's built into the guidelines. That's taken into consideration. At least we presume it's taken into consideration in the guidelines. That's one of the paramount purposes of the guidelines, to address that issue. So if I'm going to order the execution sentence, I don't call the commissioner first and say, have you got a bed available? First of all, I do not have the research tools to figure that out. I wouldn't think it would be appropriate for me to call and start asking that question. So the short answer is no. We do the sentence, follow the guidelines. Before we look at the sentencing guidelines, you also asked me to address some issues about bail and release.
Right.
Obviously, the bail issue is a real sensitive issue to the public, and it is perhaps the most difficult issue that a judge faces, because every now and then, although most people on bail don't cause any problem while they're on bail, every now and then we find this person released on bail and kills somebody or molests somebody, and it's a terrible tragedy, no question about it. I'll just tell you what we did in Ramsey County. We have an organization called Project Reman, which is primarily a bail screening organization. And the function of Project Reman is to collect as much information about this individual and to attempt to predict, and ultimately the judge, I guess, predicts this, whether or not this person, if granted bail, will remain law-abiding, and number two, will return for court appearances, those two things. We start with the premise that everyone is entitled to bail in Minnesota. So it's, you know, that's not an issue. You're entitled to bail. Now, if I want to defeat that disingenuously, I can set a $10 million bail on anybody, and there isn't anybody going to make that. And so I've defeated it. But, I'm not sure that's a responsible thing to do, and that's not what this should be about. So we look carefully at what the bail screeners come up with, and they look at, does this person have a place to live? Does the person have a job? Does the person have family support? What's the person's past criminal history? What types of crimes are we talking about? Some of this information might come from the individual himself if that person's willing to talk, or if not, it comes from all kinds of collateral sources. So we get that bail screening recommendation, and they do it on a point basis, a plus or minus, and kind of look at it, and at a certain cutoff, it's presumptive bail of a certain amount, and we've got some relatively objective factors going on there. In addition to that, we will have whatever the county attorney is going to present to us as background of this offense and what this is all about, and from that we can make some predictions, and of course the county attorney should have, and almost always has, something about the person's criminal history, so we can look at that as well. We listen to the arguments of the lawyers. Of course, those are arguments of advocates, so we take that into consideration, and we make the best possible decision with that information that we can in setting a dollar amount of bail if we're going to release the person on bail.
Judge Schumacher, I believe in Minnesota, I think that the judge can take into consideration the safety of the victim of the crime, but he can't take into account the safety of any other people, even though there may be much more known danger to other people. Is that correct?
No, I guess that's not my understanding. Just broadly, if he'll remain law-abiding, and that would include, the law-abiding part is principally public safety. It's broader than that, but it's principally public safety. And for instance, you might be referring to a domestic between these two people. And the question is, he's a risk to this victim, but is he a risk to other people? I would take that in consideration if I have that information.
Okay.
Yeah. In other words, he doesn't get along with his employer either, and he's assaulted with his employer, his neighbors, his spouse. All of those things are factors.
That's good to know. Representative Johnson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, could you say just a little bit about how the bonds people actually work? I mean, when you have a $10,000 bond, you can get out by, putting up $1,000? Is that how?
Yeah, my understanding is, and I've been removed from this for a little while, but my understanding is a 10% bail bond fee with collateral. And so if you're going to have to purchase a $100,000 bond or $10,000 bond, let's say, and you're paying $1,000, that's not all there is. You're going to put up some collateral so that if you default on the bond, they take the house or whatever else it is. Yeah, generally that's how that works. And in my experience, the bail bonds people have been pretty good when someone hasn't shown up and going and getting them. They've been really, I have to say, exemplary with that. They find them, and they have an economic incentive to do that, right? So it's the power of money, but they do that. We might, in addition to bail, just setting bail, we might impose other release conditions. If it's a domestic or some kind of assaultive kind of thing, there's a no-contact order. You are to have no contact of any sort, telephone, personally, through other people, anything. If you do that, that will violate your release condition, will forfeit your bail, and you're back in, you sit back in jail. Or maybe we have short-term drug treatment pending the outcome of the case, or any number of conditions that might make some sense to perform. So let's assume then we have granted bail to this individual, we've set a sentencing date, and in the interim, this person will report to the probation agent, and the probation agent then will collect information to give us a pre-sentence investigation report, which is a very detailed report about this person's history and background and current crime and anything else that might pertain to sentencing. In addition to that report, the probation agent will prepare a sentencing guidelines worksheet and will work off the sentencing guidelines grid. And maybe this is an appropriate time to show, first of all, the grid. Oh, do we have that up there? No. Okay, way ahead of me. Okay, this is the determinate sentencing grid that deals with two axes. The vertical axis indicates the severity of the crime. The sentencing commission determines the severity level of the crime and will appropriately place the crime. Most crimes, not all, but most crimes, the vast majority of crimes, will be represented on this grid 1 through 11. And even though on the actual grid we've got a particular crime stated, if you look up the tables you can find out what the other crimes are. So that's the first thing, how severe the crime was. And on the horizontal axis we look at criminal history. Criminal history is primarily past felony record, but it can be more than that. Do we have a couple of slides. Maybe you can just skip over to that. Okay. Here's the criminal history section of the worksheet. So we look at how many past felonies this person's had, getting a point for each one, or whether the person was in custody at the time the offense was committed, that's another point. Some prior juvenile offenses, depending what they are, prior misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor, they get partial points and they all add up. We put all this together, and then as you can see, if we go back to the grid, you take the severity level, let's say it's severity level 7, and you look across the grid, let's say we end up with a criminal history of 3. What's that? Okay. Criminal history of 3 would, in this box, would have 54 months, and the blue area, is it coming out blue for you? Okay. The blue area would be a presumptive commitment to the Commissioner of Corrections. If he fell in, let's say he only has 2 points with a history of 7, then he would have 48 months, and the numbers aren't showing there, right?
No.
Okay. You have the numbers. 48 months, but that would be a presumptive stay. Presumptive stay of execution, by the way. So that's kind of how this works. So the probation agent then would take a look at the grid and indicate, well, the presumptive sentence is whatever happens on the grid. Maybe you can just show the worksheet, and I guess they have the worksheet.
They have a copy.
Okay. Oh, that's fine. Okay, so you can see what happens. this worksheet then, with reference to the grid, gets presented to the sentencing judge for review before the actual sentencing. The judge then will have an opportunity to read through the pre-sentence investigation report, an opportunity to double-check the sentencing grid to make sure that's the sentence. And let's assume it's just a straight-up plea and there's no sentencing aspect to the plea. Perhaps he was charged with three crimes and the prosecution said, we're going to drop two of them if you plead to this one, and the sentencing guideline sentence will be imposed. Everything's fine, okay, and that's what he gets. We pronounce the sentence, and there he goes. If it's a stay of execution or a stay of imposition, as I indicated before, then he gets placed on probation, and invariably, I can't think of a time when it was just probation with no conditions. I don't recall that I've ever done that. So there are always some conditions to be imposed. The recurring condition is that you keep in contact with your probation agent, because he or she is the person on a day-to-day basis, although it's not daily contact, but so to speak, on a day-to-day basis, is the one who is monitoring and determining this person's success on probation or violation of probation. So that's a recurring condition. Condition number two that's recurring, remain law-abiding in all respects. Then we look at some particulars. Let's assume alcohol or drugs are involved somehow here. So a recurring condition is abstain from all alcohol or other illegal substances. That is not prescribed for a condition by a physician, a legitimate condition by a physician. Go to drug treatment if that looks like it's appropriate. By the way, we're relying heavily on the recommendations of the probation agents as to conditions of probation, other than the recurring ones that I've just mentioned to you, because they are the experts in the field. I know a little bit about the drug programs out there, but I have not been able to get into an intensive investigation about those programs, whereas the probation officers are doing that on an ongoing basis. They're looking into the programs and assessing the suitability of a particular program for this individual, and so we really pay close attention to the recommendations.
Judge Schumacher, just as a question, for instance, I know you have these guidelines, and let's say, I think at one time at least, maybe still, let's say I'm just looking at assault second degree, six and six or more, there's 49 to 68 is the, and then I think you're supposed to write up some reason if you went over 68 months on a sentence. But what if it's a presumed commit, and you decide to stay it? Could you then increase the number of months beyond these months without having to justify it?
No, that's a good question. Now we're kind of into departures here. So you look at your grid, and if you've got a 48-month commit, and then you've got actually some leeway there. You've got a low side and a high side. That's the range within which the judge has some discretion and can impose a sentence other than the middle number without any justification. That's still part of the permissible range. If you go below that or above that, first of all, in duration, we call that a durational departure. It is either an aggravated durational departure, you've exceeded the top number, or a mitigated departure, durational departure, you've gone below the top number. Okay, so that's one way to depart. The other way to depart is if you take an executed sentence, presumptively executed sentence, and stay it, and you say, okay, I'm giving you the same amount of time, but I'm not going to send you to prison. Rather, I'm going to stay it and put you on probation. That's a departure. You have to justify that. If you say, I'm going to execute it, I'm going to stay it, but I'm going to give you more time, it's still a departure. So my message here is anything beyond what the sentencing guidelines calls for, up or down, in or out, would be a departure that you have to justify by substantial and compelling reasons stated on the record. Does that answer that?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So now one other thing I want to say about probationary conditions.
if we have a stayed sentence, felony sentence, we can still give a jail sanction up to 1 year in jail. It's a local jail, it's not a prison, okay? So, Ramsey County, you go to the workhouse, outstate, there are local jails and facilities, Hennepin County's got a workhouse, and maybe some others. So you can still get jail time. So I don't want to leave you with the impression, you probably already know this, so I'm sorry if I'm telling you something you already know, but some people, at least the public, thinks probation means that there's no jail sanction, and that's not true. Now, I can't tell you in every sentence there's a jail sanction, but in maybe the majority of sentences, there is some jail sanction of some sort, and it can be up to a year. So I might stay this 48-month sentence, if that's what's called for, and give him 120 days in the Ramsey County Workhouse.
Representative Olin?
Yeah, Mr. Mallory, and Judge, would you explain what happens if you use the jail time? How does that affect the violation later, just so people understand what that actual 90 days or year or whatever does to your actual length of prison after that?
Yeah, generally you'd be given credit against the sentence for the time that you have spent in jail. With the appellate cases and the Supreme Court primarily doing this, pretty much any time you have spent time in custody, jail-type custody, you're going to get that time knocked off your sentence somewhere along the line. So that's it. But anyway, so you can get this jail time as part of your probationary conditions.
Judge Schumacher, I have a question on that issue. Is that by law or by judicial rule?
The jail time credit, I believe it's by statute, and it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court as to what it applies to. I think it's statutory, isn't it?
It is statutory.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. The release conditions are generally require probationary supervision, so you report to a probation agent. Depending on the crime, if it's a low-level crime and a person's got a clean prior history, that person may be placed on probation without any supervision, and that would mean that basically just has to remain law-abiding and not certainly repeat this crime, and at the end, that's it. He doesn't have to report to his probation officer because there isn't any assigned. I think that's the exception, not the rule. Usually we will sentence him to a condition of having a probation agent. So that's kind of the process with the trial judge, pretty much in a general way. I don't know if there are any other questions about that process.
Doesn't look like it. Maybe you could briefly do the role of the appellate court in sentence issues.
Okay.
Some hot sentence issues or something.
Yeah. Sentencing is the appellate rule is sentencing is discretionary with the trial judge. But discretionary means that the trial judge doesn't have discretion to simply ignore the guidelines. For instance, I'd say, well, you know what, I hate burglars, and I don't care what the guidelines say. I think all burglars should go to prison for 96 months, and that's what I'm going to do. I've abused my discretion because I am to follow the law. The law is the guidelines. I can depart, as I've said, but I have to have substantial and compelling reasons, and my personal predilections are not substantial and compelling reasons, and are really not fair across the board and don't comport with the values of the determinant sentencing system. So we look at the sentence in terms of abuse of discretion. One way a judge could abuse discretion is to depart from the guidelines without giving any reasons. And that will get reversed. There's no question about it. We'll reverse that because you have to give reasons. It used to be that the reason was that the prosecutor and defense lawyer and defendant just agreed to this sentence, even though it wasn't a guideline sentence. That violates the guidelines, and it took a few years for that to get straightened out, but now that's clear, that's not good enough. Just because three entities have chosen to ignore the law and not apply it, that's not good enough. There still has to be a substantial and compelling reason beyond your agreement. So that would be an abuse of discretion. Excessive departures upward, usually. And, you know, this is, we don't really have any hard and fast law on this, but if you quadruple the sentence, well, you really, really have to have a very, very substantial reason to quadruple. Double departures are more likely. Once in a while, a triple departure. When you start going beyond that, you have problems. Or downward departures are less problematic generally on appeal, but if the downward departure just kind of negates the sentencing, then you might have an abuse of discretion there. So that's one area. Departures is an area of kind of recurring appellate problems. The second area, since, as I told you, most of the cases come to us through pleas and not through convictions after trial, we have defendants who have been sentenced and then claim that the plea bargain has been violated in one way or the other, or he didn't want to hear. Here's a typical one. I didn't realize, I'm a foreign citizen, and I didn't realize that if I pleaded guilty to this crime, that I would probably be deported, and nobody ever told me about that. Well, now the case law has made a distinction between direct consequences of your plea and collateral consequences. Direct consequences are things like jail time and things related to custody. Collateral consequences are things that might happen to you because of your status that really isn't so pertinent to the crime or the commission of the crime or the sentence. So the fact that you were a foreign citizen and some other agency might do something to you is not, that's a collateral consequence, and it's not something that is going to allow us to overturn that plea agreement. I'll give an example of one that's kind of interesting, a unique thing that we've just dealt with, and that is a guy was charged with a drug offense in one of our outlying counties, and before he was brought to trial on that offense, he was charged with a separate drug offense in the federal system and pleaded guilty and went into federal custody. He wasn't put into federal prison. I don't know where they take him, but they hang on to him awaiting an assignment to federal prison. In the meantime, he was sent back to the state county to face the state charges. And the prosecutor and the defendant and defense lawyer worked out a deal whereby he would plead guilty, he would go to prison, but he would serve his time concurrently with the federal time. What happened was he was sent to the state prison. And the feds don't give you any, you asked about the time credit, feds don't give you any time credit for that. It should have been just the other way around. He should have gone to the federal prison, and the state does give time, and that's where we got concurrent sentences. Well, his issue on appeal was, since he was sent to the state prison, he's got to do all his state time, and then do all his federal time, and therefore did not get the benefit of his plea bargain that he was going to be allowed to do concurrent sentencing. So that issue is before us. I can tell you, we haven't decided it yet, but I can tell you the issue is before us. It's public record. And so that's an example. That's kind of a unique one, but that's an example of how someone says, you didn't keep the plea bargain because I didn't get what you promised me to and the reason I pleaded guilty. And if you weren't going to do that, then I was going to put you to the task of having a trial and prove me guilty. So that's one we have to deal with. But a lot of them they're just not real happy with the sentence, and they get into prison and they start talking to some of the veterans up there who say, well, your lawyer really screwed up there, and we better go back, and he didn't tell you everything that he should have told you, and we got to get back and get this straightened out. And most of those are not with merit. I'm not prejudging anything, but just looking back, most of them are not with merit and don't get reversed. But those are the primary departures and efforts to withdraw the plea are the primary sentencing issues that we see. I would say that anything else is sporadic.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question on plea bargaining. What's your sense briefly on that? That's one thing I hear probably complaints about, that it gets used and abused in order to move cases through whatever. Do you think it's a good tool to have in the arsenal, or what's your thinking?
Well, first of all, it's a necessary tool. I think in the ideal world, not. But it's a necessary tool. And it does a couple of things. Number one, in addition to expediting cases, it allows everybody to look to see really what the charge ought to be. So I know what the public yells and screams sometimes. They say, oh, this person, I was just reading a letter to the as editor of Pioneer Press, and this individual had committed murder by bashing this woman's head against the wall until she died, right? And he pleaded guilty to second degree unintentional murder. And the letter said, unintentional. And he gave an analogy. If I held her head underwater until she died, could I say that was unintentional? And the answer is no, but I know what happened there. It was a plea bargain. And the deal was, you're charged with intentional murder, probably not first degree premeditated murder. It was a heat of the moment kind of thing, but intentional murder. However, unintentional gets you just about the same sentence and will satisfy what we want to satisfy, and so we'll let you plead guilty to that. Public's perception is, what kind of a plea bargain is this? Doesn't make any sense at all. Sounds irrational, and how can it be? And the public doesn't get all the information. But, you know, I suppose plea bargains can be abused. And I probably have seen that sometimes. And when I was a sentencing judge, I simply wouldn't accept it then. I don't care what your bargain is. It's not going to happen. The ones I've accepted, there were some that I thought, yeah, I guess I can live with it. I'm not thrilled about it, but it seems to make some sense, some degree of sense. We do this trade-off is what our society is all about. We're doing trade-offs all the time. Maybe even the legislature sometimes gets into some trade-offs. I don't know.
No, never.
Probably not.
Never, and we're going to testify that if you ever are judging a case on knowledge of a law.
Well, that's right. I've just written that down, though, Chairman Mulroney, so okay. So I remember that. The other thing, Representative Johnson, the other thing is that some cases are overcharged. And when I say that, I don't mean to disparage the prosecutors, but they're going to charge on the basis of what they have at the time. Understand then the investigation's ongoing, and the prosecutor might say, well, yeah, this is maybe a little higher charge than we can prove, number one, or than we think is just under the circumstances as they have developed, and therefore we're happy to plea bargain to something else. So it's a bit of a hedge against that. So it's not this real evil thing. It's an expedient, it's necessary, and it does some good ultimately. But if we didn't have the ability to plea bargain, you close the courts down real fast. I mean, you know, if everybody went to trial, first of all, people would sit in jail. People who are not guilty and ultimately would be found not guilty sit in jail for months and months and months. Sometimes would be in jail longer than whatever sentence they would get. And you think, wow, you know, nobody can tolerate that in a society such as ours. So, it's kind of a mixed bag.
I think we better go to several people wanted to know specifically how to go through that, and it seems like Ms. McBrayer is the expert at training. If you can train judges, you can probably even train legislators.
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Linda McBrayer, and I am the trainer for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have included in your packet the copy of both of the grids that we use, as well as an example worksheet so that you can see what the end result is of everything that I'm going to present to you. My trainings usually last approximately 6 hours, and I have condensed this down into 8 slides in about 15 minutes. So bear with me, ask questions, and please remember that when you're dealing with guidelines, you're never capable of dealing with hypotheticals as well as actual cases, and that they are like artichokes. Every time you peel off a leaf, there is another leaf right underneath it that needs to be dealt with. But the basics of guidelines are as follows. We have the numeric grid, which Judge Schumacher went through and explained to you. And as of August 1st of 2006, for those offenders who have committed criminal sexual conduct or other sex-related offenses, they are sentenced off of what we call the sex offender grid or the alpha grid. These severity levels are letter A through H, and their criminal history score and stay or commitment represents the same as the numeric grid. So the grid, we find the disposition and the duration of the presumptive sentence the offender should receive. What I'd like to walk you through is how we get across that number on the top, the 0 through 6. In the worksheet, you see the current offense section of the grid, which the probation agent will include the date of the current offense, the severity level, the offense title, and any Minnesota statutes that are pertinent to the current offense conviction. The criminal history section contains, as you can see, the custody status that the offender was on when they committed the offense, and then their prior juvenile, misdemeanor, and felony level offenses that I'll take you through now step by step. When we look at custody, we're looking at any adult level custody that this person had when they committed the offense. This can be supervised or unsupervised, and it must be for a gross misdemeanor or a felony level offense. So we're not asking them to take into consideration any misdemeanor probation custody status that they had or any juvenile custody status that they had. The most current types that we see are probation, a confined status that is following an executed prison sentence, supervised release, the same, the period following incarceration, or escape from an executed sentence and they go out and commit a new crime. Again, and beginning August 1st of 2006, for offenders who commit an offense on that sex offender grid, a letter severity level, they could possibly be assigned a subsequent custody offense. If they commit an offense that's ranked at level A through G, and they are on active probation, supervised release, or custody release, conditional release, for a specific sex-related offense, they can be assigned an additional custody point. Conditional release here is statutory conditional release. It is not the kind of release that Judge Schumacher talked about, remain law-abiding, etc. We're talking about the statutory duration that follows supervised release. So it is possible now for those offenders to receive an additional custody point. Again, we're talking about the custody that they are on when they commit the offense. We take into consideration, if we can, their juvenile history. We look at this as sort of a checklist. The first time you answer no to one of these questions, you're through worrying about juvenile history and you move on. If the offender is not under the age of 25 when they have committed the current offense, we cannot consider juvenile history to count towards their total score. We need to look at whether or not their prior juvenile offenses were committed after they reached the age of 14. We need those juvenile offenses that we're considering to be felony level offenses and to have been dealt with before a juvenile court. We look at groups of two, multiples of two. So if the offender has two prior offenses that meet this criteria, they may receive 1 point. As I spoke about the artichoke, we peel away the first layer and we see that there are circumstances where a juvenile can receive multiple points. That's fairly technical. From most cases, if a person is going to receive a juvenile point, it will only be one. When dealing with their misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor history, we want them to have a minimum of 4 prior offenses that meet these conditions. We're looking at whether or not their misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor was contained on the applicable list, which is found in the guidelines. There are a specific set of misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors that can be used towards the calculation of a point. So it's not every single one out there. It is specific to approximately 50 priors. If there were any felony level offenses that resulted in less than a year and a day sentence, those can also be included in this section. And the look back period for misdemeanors is 10 years. So from the date that the current offense is being sentenced, we look back 10 years and can include any misdemeanors that had conviction dates within that time period. Yes, sir.
Just one question. Did you say approximately 50?
I believe that there, yes, Chairman Mulry, there are approximately 50 prior misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors found on the list that a probation agent can select from to award, towards awarding someone a point.
I thought you were saying they had to have 50 priors to get 1 point.
I apologize. Chairman, just to reiterate, we ask that they have a minimum of 4 of the 50. One tenth. Anyway, no more math. There is an exception, again, peeling a leaf when we have a current offense that is a felony DWI or a felony criminal vehicular operation. We have a different way of looking at prior misdemeanors and what can be included. But again, technical issues there. Last, we have the felony history. This is very specific because in most cases, felony history has an incredible impact on someone's criminal history. So we look at offenses which were sentenced to at least a year and a day being included in this. One thing that Judge Schumacher mentioned with the stay of imposition, even though a sentence is not pronounced in that, and for civil, after they complete their probation, for civil purposes, that stay of imposition becomes a misdemeanor so they can apply for a job or get an apartment. However, if they reoffend, that felony remains open for use within the criminal justice society, so a probation agent would be able to count stays of imposition in their criminal history, along with stays of execution, along with sentences which were committed. The look-back period for felonies is 15 years. We look back from the date that they committed the current offense, back 15 years looking at the expiration or discharge of the prior offense. When we weight an offense, again, all felonies are assigned a severity level. That severity level correlates to a weight. We look at the type of offense being sentenced, again, as of August 1st, 2006, when the legislature introduced the sex offender grid. There was a different way now of calculating criminal history scores for sex offender. And we look at the severity level of the prior offense so that we can assign a weight to it and count it in the criminal history. And weights run from a half a point and a half, 2 points, and 3 points. And that, in a nutshell, is how we get to the top axis of the grid, criminal history scores. Thank you.
Okay. Then the Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The look-back periods, are those prescribed by statute?
Those are prescribed in, Chairman Mulry, Representative, they're prescribed in the guidelines. I'm not sure if they're represented in statute. I'm being told they are represented in statute.
Thank you.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard reference to half points on the criminal history, correct? I just want to understand just a technical question, whether if someone ends up with 2.5 points, or they're rounded down, rounded up, or...
Chairman, Representative Kalin, yes, someone's criminal history total and final criminal history score is rounded down. So someone who had no criminal history, would had only criminal history of a prior fleeing a police officer, which is a severity level 1, carries a weight of a half a point, their criminal history on that worksheet would be represented as 0.
So you round down then?
Chairman, yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions about that? Do you want to explain quickly this form then, or is that part of your...
Chairman Mulry, that is a sentencing grid that we had up on the big screen, you can see...
You mean the one that the Judge Schumacher... Was that the whole explanation of it then?
Or? Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
If I may...
Judge Gomez?
We do have those two grids, and the reason that the commission, the legislature asked the commission to look at sex offender sentencing, and you will recall that the legislature decided that there was a category of the worst sex offenders who should not be on the guidelines but should all get life sentences. Some that are life sentences with the possibility of release, and some are actual life sentences. Similarly, in murder, murder one is a mandatory life sentence, some with the possibility of release, some without. And so those are not guidelines sentences. We looked at the rest of it, and the commission took the view that the base grid, the numerical grid, was not adequately responding to or encompassing some real differences between sex offenders and other offenders. A very important one of these was the issue of recidivism. Typically, sex offenders recidivate or repeat sex offenses less often than other offenders repeat their offenses. And if you think about the big, wide range of sex offenses, you will understand that most of them are what we call boundary offenses. So somebody goes too far, as opposed to having some aberrant, abnormal kind of target for his or her sexuality. And they're very different kinds of very different folks. One might be, in the first category, a young man who goes to a fraternity party and commits a first-degree criminal sexual conduct, but it's a so-called date rape thing. So that's a first-degree criminal sexual conduct. And that is serious business, and that is ranked high, and that carries a long sentence. That person, given how we hammer him, is never going to do that again. Really not. Whereas you have somebody who is more compulsive, that the punishment may not have that kind of impact. So if you've got a sex offender recidivating, you have by definition someone who is unusual among sex offenders. And when you put that together, you've got somebody different here. And that's true from the bottom of the scale in terms of seriousness, whether you're talking about flashings at the bottom or, you know, violent rapists at the top. You start seeing repeated offenses, you know you've got somebody who's going to be problematical and more problematical than society needs to deal with. And so the grid is constructed in such a way that people move over. Criminal history score goes up faster than for ordinary offenders because people get more points for prior custody and other kinds of, they can accumulate more points in additional ways. Also, the last box on the sentence, sex offender grid, is the maximum sentence. So they can whip themselves over to the maximum sentence in pretty short order. And that is by intention. The other thing is that the sentences at the top of the grid for the most serious offenders who remained are longer than they used to be. And the commission was in the unusual position last year when we were talking about the potential passage of the script of recommending changes which we knew were going to result in most sex offenders getting longer sentences. So that was by design. I bet that the commission has never, ever before come in and said, we want to change the grid, the process, the structure, in such a way that we are increasing the impact of the prison. That's typically not what the commission does. And that is very thoughtful and deliberate and intentional. So different kind of people. So we've got the different scheme for sentencing.
Judge Gomez, it's interesting you were saying that. Unfortunately, there's a person on this committee who exhibited on the floor that he didn't understand that what you were explaining about the recidivism among sex offenders. I know there's studies by the federal government that say exactly what you said, and also that if you have high supervision, even the level 3 types have one of probably just about the lowest recidivism rate of any crime. I've seen the national studies, and maybe you've seen some more recent than them about a year ago, but at that time they were pretty definitive. Did you have a question? Is there any further part of your presentation? You've got about... Well, you have about 10 minutes if there's any more that you think we should understand.
I personally would prefer to shut up. But my colleague, but she might just be sitting here listening to this.
No, I'm happy to shut up.
If there's no other questions, then
Before we adjourn, I'm wondering, Mr. Chairman, if you might be able to use some of your newfound power and authority now that you are not only in the majority but the chair of this committee to help Mr. Baldwin out and get him a nameplate.
Representative Coles, that shows you how much authority and power you have.
Well, I'd encourage you to consider if you have to go there. I probably think you can figure out a way to do it. But even if you got to dip into that committee budget,
Representative Coles, you know what our budget is right now? Zero.
Well, I can tell. We can probably pass a hat and get Mr. Baldwin a.
In fact, we just had a discussion on that. I believe it was yesterday. It's true. The fact that we have zero budgets right now. Okay, unless there's any other important questions like that, we're adjourned.